the City of London and international banking and the euro dollar markets. We want to understand the value and importance of the City of London as a key international financial centre. We'll look at its origins, development and importance. We'll refer to the key markets, the key sub-markets and market size, and then the importance of London historically in terms of coffee houses. Many of the largest financial markets in the world began in coffee houses in London in the 1600s and 1700s. We also need to understand London in terms of its key role in the development, emergence and subsequent growth and expansion of the international euro dollar market in the post-war period. All of these are covered in the two papers provided. London has always been one of the most important international financial centres, even following the withdrawal of the United Kingdom from the European Union, following the referendum in 2016. London remains one of the most important aggregate financial centres. While attempts have been made to move specific markets, such as derivatives and derivatives clearing, to the European continent, that's not been possible simply because financial centres such as Frankfurt, Amsterdam, Paris and Dublin just do not have the liquidity and the collateral to support these very large markets. Certain market activities have moved, although that has simply involved large international banks and securities firms rebooking some of their business through a European continental office rather than a London office. That of itself has had no impact whatsoever on the nature, significance, value and character of the City of London in the United Kingdom. In terms of the origins of the City of London itself is actually a sub-part of London. The City of London is the 1 square mile, that's 274 acres, around the Bank of England, which is based in Threadneedle Street in the centre of London. The City of London stretches from the Law Courts on the Strand in the west to the Tower of London in the east, from the Thames River in the south up to Liverpool Street, Spitalfields and Barbican in the north. London has, however, also developed new separate cities of London. Canary Wharf is essentially the investment capital of London. That's where all the main securities business operate. The West End around Knightsbridge, Chelsea, that's where many of the boutique hedge funds and other asset managers have chosen to be based. And there's also a new fourth city of London with the tech city, or the fintech city, which has emerged round Old Street, which is also called the Silicon Roundabout, which is just north of the main city of London. London itself was initially occupied by the Romans from between 43 AD to around 410 AD. The City of London consisted of 330 acres. And you can still see the remains of that around London Wall in Moorgate. The original Roman wall was 3.25 miles long. It had 6 gates. And as I've said, you can see parts of the wall structure still is preserved beside the Museum of London on London Wall beside Moorgate. London was ravaged by the plague in 1665 and then the Great Fire in 1666, which destroyed around two-thirds of the city, with all of this having to be rebuilt. By the early 1700s, however, London emerges as the largest city in the world. This was mainly because of the very substantial volume of commercial and trading activities, which were based around the warehouse districts and the docks in the east. But also, London will grow because it becomes the centre for the international gold market and the gold standard, and then the centre for international trade finance because of the foreign exchange markets, as well as bills of exchange, the bill on London being accepted and then discounted in London, as well as the letter of credit market, which supported international trade finance. London itself, the old city, is based on medieval street lines, although there is a subsequent formal planning stage which is conducted during the Victorian period, which is essentially from 1837 to around 1901. This constructs the larger modern commercial city of London around the small ancient medieval city of London itself. This was then stimulated with the development of the main railway lines, with the large stations which are built around the centre of London. You've also got the underground system, as well as with the development of hydraulic lifts, we have much higher buildings. A lot of these old buildings were actually owned by earlier church and then city livery companies, which were like trade associations. There was a large number of specific liveries which would be attached to a specific type of business. For example, woodcutters or butchers or actuaries, or all sorts of businesses would develop their own identity. They would buy their own building, and many of these still exist. They have some grand halls in the old city of London. Although what would also happen is there's the separate emergence of a private corporation of London, which essentially becomes the body for the regulation of London. It doesn't actually own London. A lot of that may still be the livery companies and aristocratic families, and then subsequently financial and other investment institutions. Although the Corporation of London has emerged as a sort of management body, it's a sort of sub-government within and for London itself. London is not like the Vatican. It's not a separate state. It doesn't have a separate formal government. It's a city managed entity within the larger urban area of London within the United Kingdom. I summarised the background to the gold standard. We essentially adopted a form of de facto gold standard from around 1717 onwards. That was essentially because the then master of the mint, Sir Isaac Newton, overpriced the value of silver. Because the silver coinage was set too high, many people wanted to buy and then export and melt down the silver. So merchants had to move on to the use of gold virtually by accident. Gold itself originated in Rome. We had the gold solidus, and then we had the Byzantine bezant. Britain itself, England, would adopt a silver standard. That was King Offa of Mercia, 757 to 796. Although subsequently, again, while we attempted to manage the silver-gold relationship in 1777, Sir Isaac Newton mispriced the silver, which forced the then England onto a gold standard effectively by accident. This is then formalised in 1816 following the Napoleonic Wars. We have the adoption of a formal gold standard. This will then last till just before the First World War. This has to be abandoned during the conditions of the First World War. Britain attempts to go back onto a gold standard with the Gold Standard Act 1925, although this rate of gold and the value of gold is set too high against sterling, so this is formally abandoned 6 years later in 1931. Many other countries are also forced to abandon the gold standard during the early 1930s. The Americans formally abandon this and then privatise all of the gold holdings under the Gold Standard Act 1934, where effectively all gold is purchased by the government in return for gold certificates. London will then re-emerge as a powerful international financial centre after the Second World War, principally because of the effects of the Bretton Woods system of managed exchange rates. We are going to design a new international financial system based on the management work of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, the development activities of the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which becomes the World Bank Group, and a proposed International Trade Organization, ITO, which becomes the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, following the US Congress rejection of the ITO, which will then be formally replaced by the World Trade Organization in 1995. The effect of this, however, is that because we have international stable markets, with the restoration of currency stability in 1958, while American markets are highly regulated, the effect is that large volumes of dollars are switched from America to London, and London essentially becomes an offshore financial centre for dollar debt. In the post-war period, London will emerge again as the most important international financial centre following the restoration of currency convertibility in 1958 and 1971 with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, and then all of the new markets, and in particular the foreign currency and derivatives markets that emerge after that as well. So London will reacquire its role as the most important international financial centre again following the Second World War, and then after the collapse of the Bretton Woods system at the beginning of the 1970s. London remains one of the most important, if not the single most important, significant international financial centre. This is based on a number of key factors, including political stability, central communications and transport, compact size, liberal economic and financial system policy, open competition policy, central time zone, and the quality of the supporting legal, accounting and other professional services available. We also just have this massive amounts of capital and liquidity that have been developed over time, the technical capability and capacity, and then the specialist professional personnel culture which has emerged over time, as well as with the English language and the trust in the English court system and the rule of law. London will remain the most important, if not one of the most important financial centres for the foreseeable future. The paper overviews the key markets, the money markets, primary money market, secondary money market, the banking markets, the euro-dollar markets, foreign exchange markets, financial derivatives. In terms of London market size, London has a population of 8.7 million with 542,000, that's over 500,000 working in the City of London alone. It pays $76 billion in taxation alone. That's 10.1% of the UK total tax bill. There's over 24,020 businesses. That was in 2020. 300 languages are spoken in the City of London. 538,000 students study in the City of London. And it represents 37% of the professional classes in the UK, all based in the City of London. London still remains, as we've said, one of the most important international financial centres. 20% of all international banking is conducted through London. Foreign banks, there's more Japanese banks in London than Tokyo. There's more United States banks in London than Manhattan in New York. It's the centre for international banks. There were over 500 banks. All the largest banks in the world had to have either a direct office, a joint venture, which is called a consortia, or at minimum a representative office, which is a marketing office that doesn't conduct actual financial services business in London. That's why London became the most important financial centre, in particular from the 1970s onwards. 70% of euro-dollar business is conducted through London. It's the fourth largest stock exchange in the world. It's one of the largest for international equity listings. 54% of the London Stock Exchange companies are international. 752 international issues were conducted in 1 year. 11.9% of the total global foreign listed companies are based in London, or listed in London, with 30% of foreign direct investment raised in London. The London Stock Exchange itself has gone down slightly. It's now the fourth largest stock market in the world, but still a very substantial player in all of these areas. Over $100 trillion in assets are under management in the UK and London now. Foreign exchange, the market's worth over $6.1 trillion. 65% of that market is based in London, partly because of geopolitical dispersion, high volume of trading, high leverage, continuous operation, low margin calls, limited number of participants, and high concentration of specialist players in the market. London is also the centre for the international over-the-counter financial derivatives market, as opposed to exchange-traded market. The market was worth over $700 trillion at one point. It was $582.1 trillion in 2020. An enormous market, most of this based in London. London's one of the most important insurance centres in the world. 6 billion premia are paid each year. 48,000 people work in the insurance area. It's the fourth largest single insurance centre in the world. 60% of the aviation market is through London, 55% of energy, 33% of shipping. London is also the centre of the international shipping market based on the Baltic Exchange. 50 to 60% of all shipping business is conducted through London. The Baltic Exchange was originally established in 1744, although merchants had earlier met in the ancient coffee houses in the city of London before, including Garraway's, the Virginia, the Baltic, the Jerusalem, and then slowly they would come together around different types of activity, different types of geographic space that would then later be formalised with the Baltic Exchange, while the London Stock Exchange and the Lloyd's Insurance Market would also emerge from early London coffee houses. The gold market is also still based in London. Gold market is worth $11.87 trillion. Now managed through our World Gold Council. 171,300 tonnes of gold have been extracted. There's 52,000 tonnes left to be withdrawn. The market still is largely based in London. London is also one of the most important international commodities markets. It's the largest market for world-based metals and precious and ferrous metals. The London Metal Exchange was originally established in 1877, with the Royal Exchange also going back to 1871. London remains one of the most powerful international financial centres in the world. We have already mentioned the fact that many of the largest markets actually began in ancient coffee houses in the city of London. The first coffee house in England was the Angel, established by Jacob in Oxford in 1650. However, Daniel Edwards' assistant, Pasquale Rosi, opened the first coffee table shack in the city of London, in St Martin's Lane, in 1652. London then became very popular very quickly. The total number of coffee houses grew very substantially. I've seen figures between 1,000 and 8,000. The point simply was this. Merchants had no place to meet. They also couldn't drink the drinking water because it wasn't clean and you would catch substantial diseases. So everyone was drinking light beer, usually a quarter dilute with water, or claret. Most people were inebriated most of the time and there was no place for merchants to meet. Therefore, when the coffee house emerges, there's this massive increase in sobriety while people have locations that they can come together to discuss business for the first time. Many of the largest markets will then emerge in these coffee houses. The London Stock Exchange began in Jonathan Miles, which was established in 1680. Lloyd's of London begins in the Lloyd's Coffee Shop, 1686, which then moves to Lombard Street in 1891. It's going to run pulpit auctions and candle-lit auctions. It establishes a newspaper, 1696 to 1697. The Lloyd's List is introduced for the first time, 1734. It moves to the Royal Exchange in 1774 and then subsequently builds its own, the Foster's Building, which is a major landmark in the City of London. The shipping markets also began in a number of separate markets, including the Jerusalem, the Virginia, the Maryland, Garraways, which had originally been set up in 1666. Merchants dealing with certain types of the world, parts of the world, would start to use particular coffee shops, so the coffee shops would create a form of geolocation attached to specific types of business and shipping areas. This would then come together with the Baltic Club and the Baltic, which was established in 1810. This would then be formalised with the creation of our Baltic Exchange, which is the main shipping exchange in the world. Gold market, commodity markets and other markets all were able to develop and grow substantially in the coffee house markets and the coffee house culture in the City of London, which emerges during the 1600s and beginning of the 1700s. The coffee house will later be replaced by the tea house, but only after the coffee shop, the coffee house, is the dominant form of business relationship, business connection in London for around 100 years. London remains one of the most powerful international financial centres in the world. One of the most important aspects of this in the post-war period was the emergence of the euro-dollar market. Essentially, London becomes the main trading centre for dollar debt in the post-war period. This partly arose as a result of the continuing power position and conditions for professional excellence in the city, while the relationships between the American government and other countries made countries nervous about leaving dollar deposits in New York and with the American banks, therefore they were transferred to London. Well, we also had other regulatory actions in the United States which further acted as an incentive to move funds elsewhere and specifically to London. We will see that there was substantial dollar holdings were moved from New York to the City of London after a US Treasury block on the transfer of 20 millions of gold in 1948 against the Czechoslovakian government, with other Middle Eastern countries also being concerned and moving around $62 million. This also affected, for example, the Egyptian government. There was substantial transfers during this period. The Americans introduced a Regulation D, which imposed a ceiling on the amount of interest payable on US dollar deposits, as well as a separate Regulation Q. Regulation D was the 3% reserve on transaction accounts, and Regulation Q, the interest rate ceiling. Again, this acts as a significant incentive which led to the movement of funds from United States to London. There was an attempt by the American authorities to establish a form of American or Yankee bond market during the 1970s, although this was largely ineffective, with London emerging as and then retaining its position as the main international financial centre for Eurobond market activity. All of this was encouraged by the authorities at the time, including, for example, Lord Cromer, the then governor of the Bank of England, while all of the other factors that we've mentioned confirm the attractiveness and value of London as an international financial centre. We will then get the emergence of three separate markets. There is an underlying interbank market whereby all of the large American banks and then British, European and Asian banks can all buy and sell funds, initially beginning with dollars. We refer to this as the euro-dollar market, as dollars were moved from America to Europe. Euro-dollar now refers to the issuance of any debt in any currency outside the country of issuance. So, euro dealings in London are euro-dollar. Renminbi dealings in London are euro-dollar. United States dollar dealings in London are euro-dollar. Sterling in London would be domestic. But also, we refer to this now in other financial centres. So, US dollars in Hong Kong is euro-dollar. Renminbi in Hong Kong would be domestic. Euro in Frankfurt, Amsterdam, Dublin is a euro-euro deal, whereas sterling in Frankfurt would be euro dollar. We now use this as a collective generic term to refer to any lending outside the local currency of the country of issuance. You've then also got the emergence of two parallel markets. We have the syndicated lending market, whereby governments and large companies will borrow very large amounts from a group of banks. And then you've also got the parallel bond market, whereby the largest companies in the world can issue bonds, which are debt instruments, directly into the market. So the euro-dollar market is essentially based on these three principal markets: a euro loan, a euro-dollar, and an underlying interbank market. The subsequent history of the bond market, the capital market, has been one of shorter durations. So we go from long fixed bonds, possibly 20-year plus, with possibly almost identical terms to the euro loans, down to shorter medium term, and then short term euro notes, 15 years, 10 years, 5 years, down to 1 year with variable interest rates, and then we have commercial paper up to 1 year. A whole series of other markets are then developed and support the core euro dollar markets. The euro dollar markets themselves collapse in the loan area by around a quarter during the 1970s, while this is compensated by the growth by four times in the bond market. We get this movement from the lending markets into the bond markets, which are securities based. Securities markets are more liquid, therefore we can raise more liquidity, which allows lower borrowing costs. Provided an issuer has good credit standing, it will almost always be more profitable to borrow in the bond markets. You can borrow more for less. The banking markets tend to be reserved for more complex transactions or where parties have any credit difficulty of any form. There's some technical terms that arise. So for example, in the Eurodollar market, although it's a deposit and lending market, we tend to talk about this as placement. Placement refers to depositing in the bond market, and then taking is used to connote borrowing. A number of issues arose with regards to the structure and operation and underlying nature of this market. A significant number of papers were issued by economists, including by notable economists such as Milton Friedman, who referred to the euro-dollar market operating on the basis of a bookkeeper's pen. There was a famous paper published by Friedman on the euro-dollar markets and first principles. I've incorporated the reference. Other people, large numbers of other people, have then commented on the operation of this. I found one very interesting paper by Fred Klopstock on money creation in the euro-dollar market. This raises a series of specific issues with regards to euro-dollar creation, euro-dollar multiplier, and euro-dollar leakage, as well as with regards to the nature of the euro-dollar deposit itself, and basically whether you can hold it as property or whether you can steal it in theft. With regards to euro-dollar creation, essentially what's happening is American banks receive dollar deposits in the United States and they transfer them to London. There is no actual movement of any funds of any form. All that happens is account balances in New York are reduced and corresponding account balances in New York are increased. We talk about the SWIFT International Payment System. That's the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication, which is the basis for the international payment system that was originally set up in 1973 with 518 banks from 22 countries. I've just summarised some of the key developments, including the core areas of technological evolution and reform that were adopted within the SWIFT system. The key point is this: SWIFT is only a messaging service. SWIFT does not transfer funds directly. It allows banks to convert messages, transfer messages between themselves and other banks on a secure, encrypted basis. The way the system actually works is simply that one bank will reduce a credit balance and another bank will increase the corresponding balance. All these represent is a claim by the account holder against the bank. Bank account values now represent 95-96% of all of the money in the world. Only 3-4% consists of coinage or banknotes. So 96% of the money in the world is not money. It's only a claim for transfer of value by an account holder against a bank. The credit multiplier and credit leakage, these refer to the fact that as banks and the interbank market lend to each other, they increase the money supply very substantially. So if $100 million is moved from New York to London, and that's then lent by 10 banks, that will increase by 10 times. So that's an enormous increase in the total money supply. We call that credit creation. Effectively, however, if you net all the claims down, you go back to the same original amount. There's also leakage. Leakage arises when one of the banks lends outside the interbank system. That's the bank between. That's the market between the banks themselves. You have leakage when funds leave that system, are lent outside, or one of the banks retains an amount as a reserve, possibly for regulatory purposes. So we talk about credit creation and we talk about credit leakage within, and then multiplier within the euro dollar system. In terms of the actual nature of what's involved legally, there was a famous decision of the House of Lords in the United Kingdom in R versus Priddy. That was R versus Priddy, Slade and Dillon, 1996, appeal cases 816. And this was concerned with whether you could steal a bank account. You could steal the funds in a bank account. It was part of an action in relation to mortgage fraud prosecutions and the judicial decisions in relation to that. Property is defined for criminal purposes as money and any other real or personal property of any form, including things in action, which are shows in actions, or other intangibles. So property is defined very widely and will include a claimer, a claim by a client against a account holder against a bank. However, the Theft Act 1968, section 15(1) applies with regard to obtaining property by deception belonging to another. And if you steal funds in an account, are you obtaining property by deception that belongs to another? This went to the House of Lords, and their lordships concluded that there was no property belonging to another to steal as such. This was only a claim, and the claim was transferred effectively by movements in credit balances, or what we could call novation or substitution. There was no actual funds in the account to steal. This caused a significant amount of comment at the time. It was referred to the English Law Commission. The Law Commission produced a report. This then led to a Theft Amendment Act 1996, and under that, there's a new offence created of obtaining money transfer by deception, retaining credits from dishonest sources, and extending loans by deception. A bank account doesn't contain anything. It's not property. It only represents a claim by the account holder against the bank for a transfer of value. You could still consider that to be a form of property, although it's not property in the sense of any physical asset. And when you transfer funds between banks, all you simply do is reduce the balance in one account and increase the balance in another. There was another famous decision in Libyan Arab Foreign Bank versus Bankers Trust. That was 1989, Queen's Bench 728. President Reagan in America had frozen the dollar-denominated assets of the Libyan government. The Libyan Arab Foreign Bank requested repayment of all funds from Bankers Trust in London. This was then considered by the English courts. Judge Christopher Staunton gave a very articulate explanation as to the nature of the euro-dollar system and money transfers and account value transfers. Two key issues arose with regards to what's called the defence of impossibility, which is referred to as the euro-dollar defence, and then illegal exchange control funds. The court concluded that the Americans could not prevent the transfer of the funds. Bankers Trust was ordered to pay $320.1 million to Libyan Arab Foreign Bank. That was 131 deposits in London, 161 in New York, plus interest. The court articulates this point that the funds do not actually exist as such. They only represent a claim. The sanctions cannot prevent this, and what the American Treasury actually had to do was it issued a license to allow Bankers Trust, which was an American bank, to transfer the funds to the Libyan Arab Foreign Bank. It was also stated in the judgment that if the creditor in such a case, if the account holder, wished to be paid in cash, they could insist on that as well. So even for $320.1 million, the account holder has the right to insist in cash if they so desired, and if this was not otherwise contractually disapplied. The paper then reviews the loan market, the nature of lending on the interbank markets. We do that usually on a floating rate basis. That was determined by the London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR. We've now replaced that with a series of other interbank offered rates in the main financial centres following difficulties that arose with regards to Barclays Bank and a scandal in London when Barclays slightly overstated its LIBOR figures during the global financial crisis to try to make it look more stable so that it would not trigger any form of run or withdrawal of funds. It was for a legitimate basis, although it was realised there was limitations within the voluntary compliance, good faith nature of the earlier LIBOR system, so that's since been replaced by other interbank offered rates, such as the SONIA rate, the sterling overnight rate in London. That's a copy of one of the earliest bonds in the world, which will then emerge into the euro bond market. That's one of the first certificates. That was the Autostrade deal. That was the first Eurobond, which was SG Warburg, 5.5%, 50 million, maturing 72 to 78. This was to build the motorway system in North Italy. We'll come back and look at the nature of the Eurodollar system and the Eurobond market in particular. Most of the bonds which are created are not held by investors directly. They're held through two global custodians, Clearstream and Euroclear. Euroclear is based in Brussels. It was originally Sedel, and then there's Clearstream in Luxembourg. These act as repositories for all of the bonds. The bonds are almost never held by investors directly because they are bearer bonds. They're for very large values, possibly $10,000, $50,000, $100,000, and they are transferable by delivery. Most of the transactions now are not even immobilized, which is where you have physical bonds which you deposit with one of the two clearing houses. They're dematerialized, which means they're only issued in an electronic form. That's a certificate of deposit. The subsequent history of the Eurobond market is shorter durations. So we have Euro notes, which are floating rate notes between 1 and 20 years, and then commercial paper up to 1 year. We have the financial derivatives markets, which grow very substantially following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system at the beginning of the 1970s. Customers needed new ways of managing interest rate and interest rate foreign currency and interest rate volatility. Financial derivatives were developed in response to that. We had always had forward contracts historically where you could buy and sell goods, including agricultural goods, forward 1 year, 2 year, 3 months, 6 months in advance. Those will be converted into futures and then swaps and then options. We'll come back and look at all of that in further detail. and then we'll also consider the nature of the securitization and structured finance market with the financial derivatives markets, so we can understand the nature, structure and operation of the euro-dollar markets and their importance in terms of the wider development, emergence as London as a key international financial centre, and then the continued importance of London in the post-war period, the post-1970s instability, the post-crisis in the 1980s, 1990s, and then the post-global financial crisis, post-EU withdrawal, and post-coronavirus period. We can understand the continuing relevance and importance of the City of London against all of these substantial difficulties in light of all of the key underlying factors which confirm London's importance and significance and which will preserve that going forward.